Hello there, and welcome to tonight's episode of Down to Sleep. This is the podcast of softly spoken stories to help you get a good night's rest. If you would like to support the podcast, hear everything first, and get to vote on what book I read next, please do join me on Patreon at patreon.com/downtosleep. There is also a YouTube channel if you would like to listen to the YouTube version, and that is youtube.com/downtosleep. But wherever you are listening, and however you are listening, I'm glad you're here. So let's tuck you in, take a nice deep breath, and let's get down to sleep. Gennaro's secretary bustled in with a new suitcase. It still had sales tags on it. "You know, Mr. Gennaro," she said severely, "when you forget to pack, it makes me think you don't really want to go on this trip." "Maybe you're right," Gennaro said. "I'm missing my kid's birthday." Saturday was Amanda's birthday, and Elizabeth had invited 20 screaming four-year-olds to share it, as well as Cappy the clown and a magician. His wife hadn't been happy to hear that Gennaro was going out of town. Neither had Amanda. "Well, I did the best I could on short notice," his secretary said. "There's running shoes your size, and khaki shorts and shirts and a shaving kit, a pair of jeans and a sweatshirt if it gets cold. The car is downstairs to take you to the airport. You have to leave now to make the flight." She left. Gennaro walked down the hallway, tearing the sales tags off the suitcase. As he passed the all-glass conference room, Dan Ross left the table and came outside. "Have a good trip," Ross said. "But let's be very clear about one thing. I don't know how bad this situation actually is, Donald, but if there's a problem on that island, burn it to the ground." "Jesus, Dan, we're talking about a big investment." "Don't hesitate. Don't think about it. Just do it, you hear me?" Gennaro nodded. "I hear you. But Hammond..." "Screw Hammond," Ross said.
My boy," the familiar raspy voice said. "How have you been, my boy?"
"Very well, sir," Gennaro replied. He leaned back in the padded leather chair of the Gulfstream 2 jet as it flew east towards the Rocky Mountains.
"You never call me anymore," Hammond said reproachfully. "I've missed you, Donald. How's your lovely wife?"
"She's fine. Elizabeth's fine. We have a little girl now."
"Wonderful, wonderful. Children are such a delight. She'd get a kick out of our new park in Costa Rica."
Gennaro had forgotten how short Hammond was as he sat in the chair. His feet didn't touch the carpeting. He swung his legs as he talked. There was a childlike quality to the man, even though Hammond must now be, what, 75, 76? Something like that. He looked older than Gennaro remembered, but then Gennaro hadn't seen him for almost 5 years. Hammond was flamboyant, a born showman, and back in 1983, he had had an elephant that he carried around with him in a little cage. The elephant was 9 inches high and 1 foot long and perfectly formed, except his tusks were stunted. Hammond took the elephant with him to fundraising meetings. Gennaro usually carried it into the room, the cage covered with a little blanket like a tea cozy. Hammond would give his usual speech about the prospects for developing what he called consumer biologicals. Then, at the dramatic moment, Hammond would whip away the blanket to reveal the elephant, and he would ask for the money. The elephant was always a rousing success. Its tiny body, hardly bigger than a cat's, promised untold wonders to come from the laboratory of Norman Atherton, the Stanford geneticist who was Hammond's partner in the new venture. But as Hammond talked about the elephant, he left a great deal unsaid. For example, Hammond was starting a genetics company, but the tiny elephant hadn't been made by any genetic procedure. Atherton had simply taken a dwarf elephant embryo and raised it in an artificial womb with hormonal modifications. That in itself was quite an achievement, but nothing like what Hammond hinted had been done. Also, Atherton hadn't been able to duplicate his miniature elephant, and he had tried. For one thing, everybody who saw the elephant wanted one. Then too, the elephant was prone to colds, particularly during winter. The sneezes coming through the little trunk filled Hammond with dread, and sometimes the elephant would get his tusks stuck between the bars of the cage.
snort irritably as he tried to get free. Sometimes he got infections around the tusk line. Hammond always fretted that his elephant would die before Atherton could grow a replacement. Hammond also concealed from prospective investors the fact that the elephant's behaviour had changed substantially in the process of miniaturization. The little creature might look like an elephant, but he acted like a vicious rodent, quick-moving and mean-tempered. Hammond discouraged people from petting the elephant to avoid nipped fingers. And although Hammond spoke confidently of $7 billion in annual revenue by 1993, his project was intensely speculative. Hammond had vision and enthusiasm, but there was no certainty that his plan would work at all, particularly since Norman Atherton, the brains behind the project, had terminal cancer, which was a final point that Hammond neglected to mention. Even so, with Gennaro's help, Hammond got his money. Between September of 1983 and November of 1985, John Alfred Hammond and his pachyderm portfolio raised $870 million in venture capital to finance his proposed corporation, International Genetic Technologies, Inc. And they could have raised more, except Hammond insisted on absolute secrecy. He offered no return on capital for at least 5 years. That scared a lot of investors off. In the end, they'd had to take mostly Japanese consortia. The Japanese were the only investors who had the patience. Sitting in the leather chair of the jet, Gennaro thought about how evasive Hammond was. The old man was now ignoring the fact that Gennaro's law firm had forced this trip on him. Instead, Hammond behaved as if they were engaged in a purely social outing. "That's too bad you didn't bring your family with you, Donald," he said. Gennaro shrugged. "It's my daughter's birthday. 20 kids already scheduled. Cake and the clown. You know how it is." "Oh, I understand," Hammond said. "Kids set their hearts on things." "Anyway, is the park ready for visitors?" Gennaro asked. "Well, not officially," Hammond said. "But the hotel is built, so there is a place to stay." "And the animals?" "Of course, the animals are all there, all in their spaces." Gennaro said, "I remember in the original proposal you were hoping for a total of 12. "Oh, we're far beyond that. We have 238 animals, Donald." 238? The old man giggled, pleased at Gennaro's reaction. "You can't imagine it. We have herds of them." 238? How many species? 15 different species, Donald." "That's incredible," Gennaro said. "That's fantastic. What about all the other things you wanted? The facilities, the computers?" "All of it. All of it," Hammond said. "Everything on that island is state of the art. You'll see for yourself, Donald, it's perfectly wonderful. That's why this concern is so misplaced. There's absolutely no problem with the island." Gennaro said, "Then there should be absolutely no problem with an inspection." "And there isn't," Hammond said. "But it slows things down. Everything has to stop for the official visit." "You've had delays anyway. You've postponed the opening." "Oh, that." Hammond tugged at the red silk handkerchief in the breast pocket of his sport coat. "It was bound to happen. Bound to happen." "Why?" Gennaro asked. "Well, Donald," Hammond said, "to explain that, you have to go back to the initial concept of the resort. The concept of the most advanced amusement park in the world, combining the latest electronic and biological technologies. I'm not talking about rides. Everybody has rides. Coney Island has rides. And these days, everybody has animatronic environments. The haunted house, the pirate den, the Wild West, the earthquake. Everyone has those things. So we set out to make biological attractions. Living attractions. Attractions so astonishing, they would capture the imagination of the entire world." Gennaro had to smile. It was almost the same speech, word for word, he had used on the investors so many years ago. And we can never forget the ultimate object of the project in Costa Rica: to make money. Hammond stared out of the windows of the jet. Lots and lots of money. I remember, Gennaro said. And the secret to making money in a park, said Hammond, is to limit your personal costs. The food handlers, the ticket takers, cleanup crews, repair teams, to make a park that runs with minimal staff. That was why we invested in all the computer technology. We automated wherever we could. I remember. But the plain fact is, Hammond said, when you put together all the animals and all the computer systems, you run into snags. Whoever got a major computer system up and running on schedule? Nobody that I know. So you've just had normal startup delays? Yes, that's right. Normal delays. I heard there were accidents during construction. Some workmen died. Yes, there were several accidents, and a total of 3 deaths. 2 workers died building the cliff road. 1 other died as the result of an earth mover accident in January. But we haven't had any accidents for months now. He put his hand on the younger man's arm. Donald, he said, believe me when I tell you that everything on the island is going forward as planned. Everything on that island is perfectly fine. The intercom clicked. The pilot said, seatbelts, please. We're landing in Shoto. Dry plains stretched away towards distant black buttes. The afternoon wind blew dust and tumbleweed across cracked concrete. Grant stood with Ellie near the jeep and waited while the sleek Grumman jet circled for a landing. I hate to wait on the money men, Grant grumbled. Ellie shrugged. Goes with the job. Although many fields of science, such as physics and chemistry, had become federally funded, paleontology remained strongly dependent on private patrons. Quite apart from his own curiosity about the island in Costa Rica, Grant understood that. If John Hammond asked for his help, he would give it. That was how patronage worked, how it had always worked. The little jet landed and rolled quickly towards them. Ellie shouldered her bag. The jet came to a stop, and a stewardess in a blue uniform opened the door. Inside, he was surprised at how cramped it was, despite luxurious appointments. Grant had to hunch over as he went to shake Hammond's hand. Dr. Grant, Dr. Sattler, Hammond said. It's good of you to join us. Allow me to introduce my associate, Donald Gennaro. Gennaro was a stocky, muscular man in his mid-30s, wearing an Armani suit and wireframe glasses. Grant disliked him on sight. He shook hands quickly. When Ellie shook hands, Gennaro said in surprise, you're a woman. These things happen, she said, and Grant thought, she doesn't like him either. Hammond turned to Gennaro. You know, of course, what Dr. Grant and Dr. Sattler do. They're paleontologists. They dig up dinosaurs. And then he began to laugh, as if he found the idea very funny. Take your seats, please, the stewardess said, closing the door. Immediately, the plane began to move. You'll have to excuse us, Hammond said, but we are in a bit of a rush. Donald thinks it's important that we get right down there. The pilot announced 4 hours flying time to Dallas, where they would refuel and go on to Costa Rica, arriving the following morning. How long will we be in Costa Rica? Grant asked. Well, that really depends, Gennaro said. We have a few things to clear up. Take my word for it, said Hammond. We'll be down there no more than 48 hours. Grant buckled his seatbelt. This island of yours we're going to. I haven't heard anything about it before. Is it some kind of secret? In a way, said Hammond. We've been very, very careful about making sure nobody knows about it, until the day we finally open that island to a surprised and delighted public. Target of opportunity. The Biosyn Corporation of Cupertino, California, had never called an emergency meeting of its board of directors. The 10 directors now sitting in the conference room were irritable and impatient. It was 8 p.m. They had been talking among themselves for the last 10 minutes, but slowly had fallen silent, shuffling papers, looking pointedly at their watches. "What are we waiting for?" one asked. "One more," Lewis Dodgson said. "We need one more." He glanced at his watch. Ron Meyer's office had said he was coming up on the 6 o'clock plane from San Diego. He should be here by now, even allowing for traffic from the airport. "You need a quorum?" another director asked. "Yes," Dodgson said. "We do." That shut them up for a moment. A quorum meant that they were going to be asked to make an important decision. And God knows they were, although Dodgson would have preferred not to call the meeting at all. But Steingarten, the head of Biosyn, was adamant. "You'll have to get their agreement for this one, Lou," he had said. Depending on who you talk to, Lewis Dodgson was famous as the most aggressive geneticist of his generation, or the most reckless. 34, balding, hawk-faced, and intense. He had been dismissed by Johns Hopkins as a graduate student for planning gene therapy on human patients without obtaining the proper FDA protocols. Hired by Biosyn, he had conducted the controversial rabies vaccine test in Chile. Now he was the head of product development at Biosyn, which supposedly consisted of reverse engineering, taking a competitor's product, tearing it apart, learning how it worked, and making your own version. In practice, it involved industrial espionage, much of it directed towards InGen Corporation. In the 1980s, a few genetic engineering companies began to ask, "What is the biological equivalent of a Sony Walkman?" These companies weren't interested in pharmaceuticals or health. They were interested in entertainment, sports, leisure activities, cosmetics, and pets. The perceived demand for consumer biologicals in the 1990s was high. InGen and Biosyn were both at work in this field. Biosyn had already achieved some success, engineering a new pale trout under contract to the Department of Fish and Game of the state of Idaho. This trout was easier to spot in streams and was said to represent a step forward in angling. At least, it eliminated complaints to the Fish and Game Department that there were no trout in the streams. The fact that the pale trout sometimes died of sunburn and that its flesh was soggy and tasteless was not discussed. Biosyn was still working on that, and the door opened and Ron Meyer entered the room, slipped into a seat. Dodgson now had his quorum. He immediately stood. "Gentlemen," he said, "we're here tonight to consider a target of opportunity. InGen." Dodgson quickly reviewed the background. InGen's startup in 1983 with Japanese investors, the purchase of 3 Cray XMP supercomputers, the purchase of Isla Nubla in Costa Rica, the stockpiling of amber, the unusual donations to zoos around the world, from the New York Zoological Society to the Ranthapur Wildlife Park in India. "Despite all these clues," said Dodgson, "we still had no idea where InGen might be going. The company seemed obviously focused on animals, and they had hired researchers with an interest in the past, paleobiologists, DNA phylogeneticists, and so on. Then, in 1987, InGen bought an obscure company called Millipore Plastic Products in Nashville, Tennessee. This was an agribusiness company that had recently patented a new plastic with the characteristics of an avian eggshell. This plastic could be shaped into an egg and used to grow chick embryos. Starting the following year, InGen took the entire output of this Millipore plastic for its own use and..." "Dr. Dodgson, this is all very interesting." "At the same time," Dodgson continued, "construction was begun on Isla Nubla. This involved massive earthworks, including a shallow lake 2 miles long in the center of the island. Plans for resort facilities were let out with a high degree of confidentiality, but it appears that InGen has built a private zoo of large dimensions on this island." One of the directors leaned forward and said, "Dr. Dodgson, so what?" It's not an ordinary zoo, said Dodgson. This zoo is unique in the world. It seems that InGen has done something quite extraordinary. They have managed to clone extinct animals from the past. What animals? Animals that hatch from eggs and that require a lot of room in a zoo. What animals? Dinosaurs, Dodgson said. They are cloning dinosaurs. The consternation that followed was entirely misplaced in Dodgson's view. The trouble with money men was that they didn't keep up. They had invested in a field, but they didn't know what was possible. In fact, there had been discussion of cloning dinosaurs in the technical literature as far back as 1982. With each passing year, the manipulation of DNA had grown easier. Genetic material had already been extracted from Egyptian mummies and the hide of a quagga, a zebra-like African animal that had become extinct. By 1985, it seemed possible that quagga DNA might be reconstituted and a new animal grown. If so, it would be the first creature brought back from extinction solely by reconstruction of its DNA. If that was possible, what else was also possible? The mastodon? The saber-toothed tiger? The dodo? Or even a dinosaur? Of course, no dinosaur DNA was known to exist anywhere in the world. But by grinding up large quantities of dinosaur bones, it might be possible to extract fragments of DNA. Formerly, it was thought that fossilization eliminated all DNA. Now that was recognized as untrue. If enough DNA fragments were recovered, it might be possible to clone a living animal. Back in 1982, the technical problems had seemed daunting, but there was no theoretical barrier. It was merely difficult, expensive, and unlikely to work. Yet, it was certainly possible, if anyone cared to try. InGen had apparently decided to try. What they have done, Dodgson said, is build the greatest single tourist attraction in the history of the world. As you know, zoos are extremely popular. Last year, more Americans visited zoos than all professional baseball and football games combined. And the Japanese love zoos. There are 50 zoos in Japan and more being built. And for this zoo, InGen can charge whatever they want. $2,000 a day, $10,000 a day. Then there's merchandising, the picture books, t-shirts, video games, caps, stuffed toys, comic books, pets. Pets? Of course. If InGen can make full-size dinosaurs, they can make pygmy dinosaurs as household pets. What child won't want a little dinosaur as a pet? A little patented animal for their very own? InGen will sell millions of them. And InGen will engineer them so that these pet dinosaurs can only eat InGen pet food. Jesus, said somebody. Exactly, said Dodgson. The zoo is the centerpiece of an enormous enterprise. You said these dinosaurs will be patented? Yes. Genetically engineered animals can now be patented. The Supreme Court ruled on that in favor of Harvard in 1987. InGen will own its dinosaurs, and no one else can legally make them. What prevents us from creating our own dinosaurs, someone said. Nothing, except that they have a 5-year start. It'll be almost impossible to catch up before the end of the century. He paused. Of course, if we could obtain examples of their dinosaurs, we could reverse engineer them and make our own, with enough modifications in the DNA to evade their patents. Can we obtain examples of their dinosaurs? Dodgson paused. I believe we can, yes. Somebody cleared his throat. There wouldn't be anything illegal about it. Oh no, Dodgson said quickly. Nothing illegal. I'm talking about a legitimate source of their DNA. A disgruntled employee, or some trash improperly disposed of, something like that. Do you have a legitimate source, Dr. Dodgson?
I do, but I'm afraid there is some urgency to the decision. InGen is experiencing a small crisis, and my source will have to act within the next 24 hours.
A long silence descended over the room. The men looked at the secretary taking notes and the tape recorder on the table in front of her.
I don't see the need for a formal resolution on this, said Dodgson. Just a sense of the room as to whether you feel I should proceed.
Slowly, the heads nodded. Nobody spoke. Nobody went on record. They just nodded, silently.
Thank you for coming, gentlemen, said Dodgson.
I'll take it from here.
Airport.
Lewis Dodgson entered the coffee shop in the departure building of the San Francisco airport and looked around quickly. His man was already there, waiting at the counter. Dodgson sat down next to him and placed the briefcase on the floor between them.
You're late, pal, the man said. He looked at the straw hat that Dodgson was wearing and laughed. What is this supposed to be? A disguise?
You never know. Dodgson suppressed his anger. For 6 months, Dodgson had patiently cultivated this man, who had grown more obnoxious and arrogant with each meeting. But there was nothing Dodgson could do about that. Both men knew exactly what the stakes were. Bioengineered DNA was, weight for weight, the most valuable material in the world. A single microscopic bacterium, too small to see with the naked eye, but containing the genes for a heart attack enzyme, which prevented frost damage to crops, might be worth $5 billion to the right buyer. And that fact of life had created a bizarre new world of industrial espionage. Dodgson was especially skilled at it. In 1987, he convinced a disgruntled geneticist to quit Cetus for Biosyn and take 5 strains of engineered bacteria with her. The geneticist simply put a drop of each on the fingernails of one hand and walked out the door. But InGen presented a tougher challenge. Dodgson wanted more than bacterial DNA. He wanted frozen embryos. He knew InGen guarded its embryos with the most elaborate security measures. To obtain them, he needed an InGen employee who had access to the embryos, who was willing to steal them, and who could defeat the security. Such a person was not easy to find. Dodgson had finally located a susceptible InGen employee earlier in the year. Although this particular person had no access to genetic material, Dodgson kept up the contact, meeting the man monthly at Carlos and Charlie's in Silicon Valley, helping him in small ways. Now that InGen was inviting contractors and advisors to visit the island, it was the moment that Dodgson had been waiting for. It meant his man would have access to embryos.
Let's get down to it, the man said. I've got 10 minutes before my flight.
You want to go over it again? Said Dodgson.
Hell no, Dr. Dodgson, said the man. I want to see the damn money.
Dodgson flipped the latch on the briefcase and opened it a few inches. The man glanced down casually.
That's all of it?
That's half of it. $750,000.
Okay, fine. The man turned away and drank his coffee. That's fine, Dr. Dodgson.
Dodgson quickly locked the briefcase. That's for all 15 species, you remember?
I remember. 15 species, frozen embryos. How am I going to transport them?
Dodgson handed the man a large can of Gillette foamy shaving cream.
That's it?
That's it.
They may check my luggage.
Dodgson shrugged. Press the top, he said. The man pressed it. White shaving cream puffed into his hand.
Not bad.
He wiped the foam on the edge of his plate.
Not bad.
The can's a little heavier than usual, that's all. Dodgson's technical team had been assembling it around the clock for the last 2 days. Quickly, he showed him how it worked.
How much coolant gas is inside?
Enough for 36 hours. The embryos have to be back in San Jose by then.
That's up to your guy in the boat, the man said. Better make sure he has a portable cooler on board.
I'll do that, said Dodgson.
Let's just review the bidding.
The deal
is the same, Dodgson said. 50,000 on delivery of each embryo. If they're viable, an additional 50,000 each.
That's fine. Just make sure you have the boat waiting at the east dock of the island, Friday night. Not the north dock where the big supply boats arrive. The east dock. It's a small utility dock. You got that?
I got it, said Dodgson. When will you be back in San Jose?
Probably Sunday.
The man pushed away from the counter.
Dodgson fretted. You're sure you know how to work the...
I know, said the man. Believe me.
I know.
Also, Dodgson said, we think the island maintains constant radio contact with InGen corporate headquarters in California, so...
Look, I've got it covered, the man said. Just relax. Get the money ready. I want it all Sunday morning in San Jose Airport in cash.
It'll be waiting for you, said Dodgson. Don't worry. Shortly before midnight, he stepped on the plane at the Dallas airport. A tall, thin, balding man of 35, dressed entirely in black. Black shirt, black trousers, black socks, black sneakers.
Ah, Dr. Malcolm, Hammond said, smiling with forced graciousness.
Malcolm grinned. Hello, John. Yes, I'm afraid your old nemesis is here.
Malcolm shook hands with everyone, saying quickly, Ian Malcolm, how do you do? I do maths.
He struck Grant as being more amused by the outing than anything else. Certainly, Grant recognized his name. Ian Malcolm was one of the most famous of the new generation of mathematicians who were openly interested in how the real world works. These scholars broke with cloistered tradition of mathematics in several important ways. For one thing, they used computers constantly, a practice that traditional mathematicians frowned on. For another, they worked almost exclusively with non-linear equations in the emerging field called chaos theory. For a third, they appeared to care that their mathematics described something that actually existed in the real world. And finally, as if to emphasize their emergence from academia into the world, they dressed and spoke with what one senior mathematician called a deplorable excess of personality. In fact, they often behaved like rock stars. Malcolm sat in one of the padded chairs. The stewardess asked him if he wanted a drink. He said, Diet Coke, shaken, not stirred. Humid Dallas air drifted through the open door. Ellie said, Isn't it a little warm for black?
You're extremely pretty, Dr. Sattler, he said. I could look at your legs all day.
But no, as a matter of fact, black's an excellent color for heat. If you remember your black body radiation, black is actually best in heat. Efficient radiation, in any case. I wear only two colors, black and gray.
Ellie was staring at him, her mouth open.
These colors are appropriate for any occasion, Malcolm continued. And they go well together. Should I mistakenly put on a pair of gray socks with my black trousers?
But don't you find it boring, wearing only two colors?
Not at all. I find it liberating. I believe my life has value, and I don't want to waste it thinking about clothing, said Malcolm. I don't want to think about what I will wear in the morning. Truly, can you imagine anything more boring than fashion? Professional sports, perhaps. Grown men swatting little balls, while the rest of the world pays money to applaud. But on the whole, I find fashion even more tedious than sports.
Dr. Malcolm, Hammond explained, is a man of strong opinions.
And mad as a hatter, Malcolm said cheerfully. But you must admit, these are non-trivial issues. We live in a world of frightful givens. It is given that you will behave like this, given that you will care about that. No one thinks about the givens, isn't it amazing? In the information society, nobody thinks. We expected to banish paper, but we actually banished thought.
Hammond turned to Gennaro and raised his hands.
You invited him.
And a lucky thing too, Malcolm said, because it sounds as if you have a serious problem.
We have no problem, Hammond said quickly. I always maintained this island would be unworkable, said Malcolm. I predicted it from the beginning. He reached into a soft leather briefcase. And I trust by now we all know what the eventual outcome is going to be. You're going to have to shut the thing down.
Shut it down? Hammond stood angrily. This is ridiculous.
Malcolm shrugged, indifferent to Hammond's outburst. I brought copies of my original paper for you to look at, he said. The original consultancy paper that I did for InGen, the mathematics are a bit sticky, but I can walk you through it. Are you leaving now?
I have some phone calls to make, said Hammond, and went into the adjoining cabin.
Well, it's a long flight, Malcolm said to the others. At least my paper will give you something to do. The plane flew through the night. Grant knew that Ian Malcolm had his share of detractors. He could understand why some found his style abrasive, his applications of chaos theory too glib. Grant thumbed through the paper, glancing at the equations. Gennaro said, Your paper concludes that Hammond's island's bound to fail?
Correct.
Because of chaos theory?
Correct.
To be more precise, because of the behavior of the system in phase space.
Gennaro tossed the paper aside and said, Can you explain this in English?
Surely, Malcolm said. Let's see where we have to start. You know what a non-linear equation is?
No.
Strange attractors?
No.
All right, let's get back to the beginning. He paused, staring at the ceiling. Physics has had great success at describing certain kinds of behavior. Planets in orbit, spacecraft going to the moon, pendulums and springs and rolling balls, that sort of thing. The regular movement of objects. These are described by what are called linear equations. Mathematicians can solve these equations easily. We've been doing it for hundreds of years.
Okay, Gennaro said.
But there is another kind of behavior which physics handles badly. For example, anything to do with turbulence, water coming out of a spout, air moving over an airplane wing, weather, blood flowing through the heart. Turbulent events are described by non-linear equations. They're hard to solve. In fact, they're usually impossible to solve. So physics has never understood this whole class of events. Until about 10 years ago, the new theory that describes them is called chaos theory. Chaos theory originally grew out of attempts to make computer models of weather in the 1960s. Weather is a big, complicated system, namely the Earth's atmosphere as it interacts with the land and the sun. The behavior of this big, complicated system always defied understanding, so naturally we couldn't predict weather. But what the early researchers learned from computer models was that even if you could understand it, you still couldn't predict it. Weather prediction is absolutely impossible. The reason is that the behavior of the system is sensitively dependent on initial conditions.
You lost me, Gennaro said.
If I use a cannon to fire a shell of a certain weight, at a certain speed, and a certain angle of inclination, and if I then fire a second shell with almost the same weight, speed, and angle, what will happen?
The two shells will land at almost the same spot?
Right, Malcolm said. That's linear dynamics.
Okay, but if I have a weather system that I start up with a certain temperature, a certain wind speed, and a certain humidity, and if I then repeat it with almost the same temperature, wind, and humidity, the second system will not behave almost the same. It'll wander off and rapidly will become very different from the first. Thunderstorms instead of sunshine. That's non-linear dynamics. They are sensitive to initial conditions. Tiny differences become amplified.
I think I see, said Gennaro. The shorthand is the butterfly effect.
a butterfly flaps its wings in Peking, and weather in New York is different.
So chaos is all just random and unpredictable, said Gennaro. Is that it?
No, Malcolm said. We actually find hidden regularities within the complex variety of a system's behavior. That's why chaos has become a very broad theory that's used to study everything, from the stock market to rioting crowds to brain waves during epilepsy. Any sort of complex system where there is confusion and unpredictability, we can find an underlying order, okay?
Okay, Gennaro said. But what is this underlying order?
It's essentially characterized by the movement of the system within phase space, Malcolm said.
Jesus, Gennaro said. All I want to know is why you think Hammond's Island can't work.
I understand, Malcolm said. I'll get there. Chaos theory says two things. First, that complex systems like weather have an underlying order. Second, the reverse of that, that simple systems can produce complex behavior. For example, pool balls. You hit a pool ball, and it starts to carom off the sides of the table. In theory, that's a fairly simple system, almost a Newtonian system. Since you can know the force imparted to the ball, the mass of the ball, you can calculate the angles at which it will strike the walls, you can predict the future behavior of the ball. In theory, you could predict the behavior of the ball far into the future, as it keeps bouncing from side to side. You could predict where it will end up 3 hours from now, in theory.
Okay, Gennaro nodded.
But in fact, Malcolm said, it turns out you can't predict more than a few seconds into the future, because almost immediately, very small effects, imperfections in the surface of the ball, tiny indentations in the wood of the table, start to make a difference. It doesn't take long before they overpower your careful calculations. So it turns out that this simple system of a pool ball on a table has unpredictable behavior.
Okay, and Hammond's project, said Malcolm,
is another apparently simple system. Animals within a zoo environment that will eventually show unpredictable behavior.
And you know this because of theory, Malcolm said.
But hadn't you better see the island to see what he's actually done?
No, that is quite unnecessary. The details don't matter.
Theory tells me that the island will quickly proceed to behave in unpredictable fashion.
And you're confident of your theory?
Oh yes, Malcolm said. Totally confident. He sat back in the chair.
There is a problem with that island. It is an accident waiting to happen.
With a whine, the rotors began to swing in circles overhead, casting shadows on the runway of San Jose Airport. Grant listened to the crackle in his earphones as the pilot talked to Tower. They had picked up another passenger in San Jose, a man named Dennis Nedry, who had flown in to meet them. He was fat and sloppy, eating a candy bar, and there was sticky chocolate on his fingers, flecks of aluminium foil on his shirt. Nedry had mumbled something about doing computers on the island and hadn't offered to shake hands. Through the plexi bubble, Grant watched the airport concrete drop away beneath his feet. He saw the shadow of the helicopter racing along as they went west towards the mountains.
It's about a 40-minute trip, Hammond said from one of the rear seats.
Grant watched the low hills rise up, and then they were passing through intermittent clouds, breaking into sunshine. The mountains were rugged. He was surprised at the amount of deforestation, acre after acre of denuded, eroded hills.
Costa Rica, Hammond said, has better population control than other countries in Central America.
But even so, the land is badly deforested. Most of this is within the last 10 years. They came down out of the clouds on the other side of the mountains. Grant saw the beaches of the west coast. They flashed over a small coastal village. "Fishing village," said the pilot. He pointed north. "Up the coast there you see the Cabo Blanco Preserve. They are beautiful beaches." The pilot headed straight out over the ocean. The water turned green, and then deep aquamarine. The sun shone on the water. It was about 10 in the morning. "Just a few minutes now," Hammond said, "and we should be seeing Isla Nubla." Isla Nubla, Hammond explained, was not a true island. Rather, it was a seamount, a volcanic upthrusting of rock from the ocean floor. "Its volcanic origins can be seen all over the island," said Hammond. "There are steam vents in many places, and the ground is often hot underfoot. Because of this, and also because of prevailing currents, Isla Nubla lies in a foggy area. As we get there, you will see..." "Ah, there we are." The helicopter rushed forward, low to the water. Ahead, Grant saw an island, rugged and craggy, rising sharply from the ocean. "Christ, it looks like Alcatraz," Malcolm said. Its forested slopes were wreathed in fog, giving the island a mysterious appearance. "Much larger, of course," Hammond said. 8 miles long and 3 miles wide at the widest point. In total, some 22 square miles, making it the largest private animal preserve in North America." The helicopter began to climb and headed toward the north end of the island. Grant was trying to see through the dense fog. "It's not usually this thick," Hammond said. He sounded worried. At the north end of the island, the hills were highest, rising more than 2,000 feet above the ocean. The tops of the hills were in fog, but Grant saw rugged cliffs and crashing ocean below. The helicopter climbed above the hills. "Unfortunately," said Hammond, "we have to land on the island. I don't like to do it because it disturbs the animals, and it's sometimes a bit thrilling." Hammond's voice cut off as the pilot said, "Starting our descent now. Hang on, folks." The helicopter started down, and immediately they were blanketed in fog. Grant heard a repetitive electronic beeping through his earphones, but he could see nothing at all. Then he began dimly to discern the green branches of pine trees reaching through the mist. Some of the branches were close. "How the hell is he doing this?" Malcolm said, but nobody answered. The pilot swung his gaze left, then right, looking at the pine forest. The trees were still close. The helicopter descended rapidly. "Jesus," Malcolm said. The beeping was louder. Grant looked at the pilot. He was concentrating. Grant glanced down and saw a giant glowing fluorescent cross beneath the plexibubble at his feet. There were flashing lights at the corners of the cross. The pilot corrected slightly and touched down on a helipad. The sound of the rotors faded and died. Grant sighed and released his seatbelt. "We have to come down fast that way," Hammond said, "because of the wind shear. There's often bad wind shear on this peak and, well, we're safe." Someone was running up to the helicopter. A man with a baseball cap and red hair. He threw open the door and said cheerfully, "Hi, I'm Ed Regis. Welcome to Isla Nubla, everybody. Watch your step, please." A narrow path wound down the hill. The air was chilly and damp. As they moved lower, the mist around them thinned, and Grant could see the landscape better. It looked, he thought, rather like the Pacific Northwest, the Olympic Peninsula. "That's right," Regis said. "Primary ecology is deciduous rainforest, rather different from the vegetation on the mainland, which is more classical rainforest. But this is a microclimate.
that only occurs at elevation on the slopes of the northern hills. The majority of this island is tropical. Down below, they could see the white roofs of large buildings nestled among the planting. Grant was surprised. The construction was elaborate. They moved lower, out of the mist. Now he could see the full extent of the island, stretching away to the south. As Regis had said, it was mostly covered in tropical forest. To the south, rising above the palm trees, Grant saw a single trunk with no leaves at all. Just a big, curving stump. Then, the stump moved and twisted around to face the new arrivals. Grant realized that he was not seeing a tree at all. He was looking at the graceful, curving neck of an enormous creature, rising 50 feet into the air. He was looking at a dinosaur. "My God," Ellie said softly. They were all staring at the animal above the trees. "My God." Her first thought was that the dinosaur was extraordinarily beautiful. Books portrayed them as oversized, dumpy creatures, but this long-necked animal had a gracefulness, almost a dignity, about its movements. And it was quick. There was nothing lumbering or dull in its behavior. The sauropod peered alertly at them and made a low trumpeting sound, rather like an elephant. A moment later, a second head rose above the foliage, and then a third, and a fourth. "My God," Ellie said again. Gennaro was speechless. He had known all along what to expect. He had known about it for years, but he had somehow never believed it would happen. Now he was shocked into silence. The awesome power of the new genetic technology, which he had formerly considered to be just so many words in an overwrought sales pitch, the power suddenly became clear to him. These animals were so big. They were enormous, big as a house, and so many of them. Actual damned dinosaurs, just as real as you could want. Gennaro thought, "We are going to make a fortune on this place. A fortune." He hoped to God that the island was safe. Grant stood on the path on the side of the hill, the mist on his face, staring at the grey necks craning above the palms. He felt dizzy, as if the ground was sloping away too steeply. He had trouble getting his breath, because he was looking at something he had never expected to see in his life. Yet, he was seeing it. The animals in the mist were perfect apatosaurs, medium-sized sauropods. His stunned mind made academic associations. North American herbivores, late Jurassic horizon, commonly called brontosaurs, first discovered by E.D. Cope in Montana in 1876. Specimens associated with Morrison Formation strata in Colorado, Utah, and Oklahoma. Recently, Berman and McIntosh had reclassified it a Diplodocus based on skull appearance. Traditionally, Brontosaurus was thought to spend most of its time in shallow water, which would help support its large bulk. Although this animal was clearly not in water, it was moving too quickly, the head and neck shifting above the palms in a very active manner. A surprisingly active manner. Grant began to laugh. "What is it?" Hammond said, worried. "Is something wrong?" Grant just shook his head and continued to laugh. He couldn't tell them that what was funny was that he had seen this animal for only a few seconds, but he had already begun to accept it and to use his observations to answer long-standing questions in the field. He was still laughing as he saw a fifth and sixth neck
crane up above the palm trees. The sauropods watched the people arrive. They reminded Grant of oversized giraffes. They had the same pleasant, rather stupid gaze. "I take it they're not animatronic," Malcolm said. "They're very lifelike."
"Yes, they certainly are," Hammond said. "Well, they should be, shouldn't they?"
From the distance, they heard the trumpeting sound again. First, one animal made it, and then the others joined in.
"That's their call," Ed Regis said, "welcoming us to the island."
Gran stood and listened, entranced. "You probably want to know what happens next," Hammond was saying, continuing down the path. "We've scheduled a complete tour of the facilities for you, and a trip to see the dinosaurs in the park later this afternoon. I'll be joining you for dinner, and we'll answer any remaining questions you may have then. Now, if you'll go with Mr. Regis..." The group followed Ed Regis towards the nearest buildings. Over the path, a crude hand-painted sign read, "Welcome to Jurassic Park." They moved into a green tunnel of overarching palms, leading toward the main visitor building. Everywhere, extensive and elaborate planting emphasized the feeling that they were entering a new world, a prehistoric tropical world, leaving the normal world behind. Ellie said to Grant, "They look pretty good." "Yes," Grant said. "I want to see them up close. I want to lift up their toe pads and inspect their claws, feel their skin, open their jaws, and have a look at their teeth. Until then, I don't know for sure, but yes, they look good."
I suppose it changes your field a bit," said Malcolm.
Grant shook his head. "It changes everything," he said. For 150 years, ever since the discovery of gigantic animal bones in Europe, the study of dinosaurs had been an exercise in scientific deduction. Paleontology was essentially detective work, searching for clues in the fossil bones and the trackways of the long-vanished giants. The best paleontologists were the ones who could make the most clever deductions. All the great disputes of paleontology were carried out in this fashion, including the bitter debate in which Grant was a key figure about whether dinosaurs were warm-blooded. Scientists had always classified dinosaurs as reptiles, cold-blooded creatures drawing the heat that they needed for life from the environment. A mammal could metabolize food to produce bodily warmth, but a reptile could not. Eventually, a handful of researchers, led chiefly by John Ostrom and Robert Backer at Yale, began to suspect that the concept of sluggish, cold-blooded dinosaurs was inadequate to explain the fossil record. In classic deductive fashion, they drew conclusions from several lines of evidence. First was posture. Lizards and reptiles were bent-legged sprawlers, hugging the ground for warmth. Lizards didn't have the energy to stand on their hind legs for more than a few seconds, but the dinosaurs stood on straight legs and many walked erect on their hind legs. Among living animals, erect posture occurred only in warm-blooded mammals and birds. Thus, dinosaur posture suggested warm-bloodedness. Next, they studied metabolism, calculating the pressure necessary to push blood up the 18-foot-long neck of a brachiosaur, concluding that it could be only accomplished by a four-chambered, hot-blooded heart. They studied trackways, fossil footprints left in the mud, concluded that dinosaurs ran as fast as a man. Such activity implied warm blood. They found dinosaur remains above the Arctic Circle, in a frigid environment unimaginable for a reptile. And the new studies of group behavior, based largely on Grant's own work, suggested that dinosaurs had a complex social life and reared their young, as reptiles did not. Turtles abandoned their eggs, but dinosaurs probably did not.
The warm-blooded controversy had raged for 15 years, before a new perception of dinosaurs as quick-moving, active animals was accepted, but not without lasting animosities. At conventions, there were still colleagues who did not speak to one another. But now, if dinosaurs could be cloned, Grant's field of study was going to change instantly. The paleontological study of dinosaurs was finished. The whole enterprise, the museum halls with their giant skeletons and flocks of echoing schoolchildren, the university laboratories with their bone trays, the research papers, the journals, all of it was going to end. "You don't seem upset," Malcolm said. Grant shook his head. "It's been discussed in the field. Many people imagined it was coming, but not so soon." "Story of our species," Malcolm said, laughing. "Everybody knows it's coming, but not so soon." As they walked down the path, they could no longer see the dinosaurs, but they could hear them trumpeting softly in the distance. Grant said, "My only question is, where'd they get the DNA? Grant was aware of serious speculation in laboratories in Berkeley, Tokyo, and London that it might eventually be possible to clone an extinct animal such as a dinosaur, if you could get some dinosaur DNA to work with. The problem was, all known dinosaurs were fossils, and the fossilization destroyed most DNA, replacing it with inorganic material. Of course, if a dinosaur was frozen, or preserved in a peat bog, or mummified in a desert environment, its DNA might be recoverable. But nobody had ever found a frozen or mummified dinosaur, so cloning was therefore impossible. There was nothing to clone from. All the modern genetic technology was useless. It was like having a Xerox copier, but nothing to copy with it. Ellie said, "You can't reproduce a real dinosaur, because you can't get real dinosaur DNA." "Unless there's a way that we haven't thought of," Grant said. "Like what?" she said. "I don't know," Grant said. Beyond a fence, they came to the swimming pool, which spilled over into a series of waterfalls and smaller rocky pools. The area was planted with huge ferns. "Isn't this extraordinary?" Ed Regis said. "Especially on a misty day, these plants really contribute to the prehistoric atmosphere. These are authentic Jurassic ferns, of course." Ellie paused to look more closely at the ferns. "Yes, it was just as he said. Serena veriformans, a plant found abundantly in fossils more than 200 million years old, now common only in the wetlands of Brazil and Colombia. Whoever had decided to place this particular fern at poolside obviously didn't know that the spores of veriformans contained a deadly beta-carboline alkaloid. Even touching the attractive green fronds could make you sick, and if a child were to take a mouthful, he would almost certainly die. The toxin was 50 times more poisonous than oleander. People were so naive about plants, Ellie thought. They just chose plants for appearance, as they would choose a picture for the wall. It never occurred to them that plants were actually living things, busily performing all the living functions of respiration, ingestion, excretion, reproduction, and defense. But Ellie knew that, in the Earth's history, plants had evolved as competitively as animals, and in some ways more fiercely. The poison in Serena veriformans was a minor example of the elaborate chemical arsenal of weapons that plants had evolved. There were terpenes, which plants spread to poison soil around them, inhibit competitors, alkaloids, which made them unpalatable to insects and predators and children, pheromones used for communication. When a Douglas fir tree was attacked by beetles, it produced an antifeeding chemical. And so did other Douglas firs in distant parts of the forest. It happened in response to a warning alleochemical secreted by trees that were under attack.
People who imagined that life on Earth consisted of animals moving against a green background seriously misunderstood what they were seeing. That green background was busily alive. Plants grew, moved, twisted, turned, fighting for the sun. They interacted continuously with animals, discouraging some with bark and thorns, poisoning others, and feeding still others to advance their own reproduction, to spread their pollen and their seeds. It was a complex, dynamic process which she never ceased to find fascinating, and which she knew most people simply didn't understand. But if planting deadly ferns at poolside was any indication, then it was clear the designers of Jurassic Park had not been as careful as they should have been. "Isn't it just wonderful?" Ed Regis was saying. "If you look up ahead, you'll see our safari lodge." Ellie saw a dramatic, low building, with a series of glass pyramids on the roof. "That's where you'll all be staying here in Jurassic Park." Grant's suite was done in beige tones, the rattan furniture in green jungle print motifs. The room wasn't quite finished. There were stacks of lumber in the closet, and pieces of electrical conduit on the floor. There was a television set in the corner, with a card on top. Channel 3, Triceratops territory. Channel 4, Sauropod swamp. Channel 5, Carnivore country. Channel 6, Stegosaurus south. Channel 7, Velociraptor valley. Channel 8, Pterosaur peak. He found the names irritatingly cute. Grant turned on the television, but got only static. He shut it off and went into his bedroom, tossed his suitcase on the bed. Directly over the bed was a large, pyramidal skyline. It created a tented feeling, like sleeping under the stars. Unfortunately, the glass had to be protected by heavy bars, so striped shadows fell across the bed. Grant paused. He had seen the plans for the lodge, and he didn't remember bars on the skylight. In fact, these bars appeared to be a rather crude addition. A black steel frame had been constructed outside the glass walls, the bars welded to the frame. Puzzled, Grant moved from the bedroom to the living room. His window looked out on the swimming pool. "By the way, those ferns are poison," Ellie said, walking into his room. "But did you notice anything about the rooms, Alan?" "They changed the plans." "I think so, yes." She moved around the room. "The windows are small," she said. "The glass is tempered, set in a steel frame. The doors are steel clad. That shouldn't be necessary." "Did you see the fence when we came in?" Grant nodded. The entire lodge was enclosed within a fence, with bars of inch-thick steel. The fence was gracefully landscaped and painted flat black to resemble wrought iron, but no cosmetic effort could disguise the thickness of the metal, or its 12-foot height. "I don't think the fence was in the plans either," said Ellie. "It looks to me like they've turned this place into a fortress." Grant looked at his watch. "We'll be sure to ask why," he said. "The tour starts in 20 minutes.